Welcome back to Roaming with Restless Women. Today I have Sally Raymond. Sally is a practicing marriage and family therapist in Southern California. She's a speaker, author, and a passionate, devoted expert on the topics of life and healthy growth, suicide, and relationships. With six other therapists, she co-founded Children's Path Programs, a nonprofit dedicated to helping children attain their passion and potential. She's also a founding board member of Freedom for Youth, a nonprofit dedicated to ending the school-to-prison pipeline for at-risk youth. In 1991, at just 23 years old, Sally's son, John, gunned his car into a retaining wall and was instantly killed. The shot catapulted her into an arduous journey of personal retrospective and extensive research, which just culminated in her recently released book, The Son I Knew Too Late, A Guide to Help You Survive and Thrive. The book was written to help parents, sufferers, and loved ones and friends knowledgeably support young people's individual stability, progress, inner growth, and resilience through all stages of development. Since his suicide, Sally has been on a mission. And that is to tell John's stories in a way that will help others avoid what he did and what she did not. For the truth is, all that has been done to prevent suicide isn't working, and we all know that. Suicide recently rose to be the second leading cause of death among Americans aged 15 to 24, and that's just a shame. So, Raymond's book is a life thrival. I knew I was going to mess that up. A life thrival guide and suicide prevention resource for parents, teachers, and those who work with youth. A first of its kind blueprint for taking action to save lives at any age. Welcome, Sally. I'm so excited to talk with you about this great topic. It's horrible that we have to live in an age where kids don't feel like that they're worth anything.
Yep.
Where they are struggling so hard, and we as parents, as grandparents, as teachers and educators aren't really equipped right now to
No.
see it and deal with it. So can you talk a little bit about your practice and the mission that you're on?
Well, thank you so much, Julie. It's a pleasure to be here and to meet, get to know you too. And I just was thrown on a mission when my son killed himself. I was just being licensed as a psychotherapist, and none of my stories about John as a mom could have possibly ended like that, which meant that I'd missed his pain. And that was intolerable to me. I couldn't live with that. I couldn't bear it. And I had to find out. And I just had gotten the tools in place with my new licensure to possibly find out what I missed. And that has taken me my that is my whole life right now. That is all I care about, because all I want is that nobody else, either suffers like John did or does something like that, or the aftermath, the shock, the horror, and the loss. Because when somebody, I didn't know this until he died, but when he died, I watched a whole galaxy of people, including myself, obliterate. And none of them could be the same again. None of them would be stable again. Nobody, it would be a completely different world because John wasn't in it anymore. And I now know that every single one of us is the center of a galaxy. You don't know that, but you are the center of a galaxy. And your life is what centers that galaxy and gives it consistency, stability, identity, future, hope, all of that. And when that goes, when that center goes, you just peel off and ricochet out and crash, and everything is destroyed. And nobody knows that. And I had to find that out the hard way. So I am, so dedicated to helping life worth stay worth the living, because I believe that that's what suicide prevention really is to keep life worth living. It's the simplest thing, but we aren't doing it in America. We are not doing it in America. America is disintegrating in front of our eyes right now, and it's all because what we stopped teaching, what we stopped doing. And that's what I've been doing for the past 21 years. One of the things I came up with that I realized John was deficit in, and most kids are today, is social emotional skills. Learning
Absolutely.
how to get along with others, learning how to regulate your emotions, learning how to say critical things in a way other people will say, "Thank you, that's a great idea. I never thought of that." You know, we can do this. We can do this. And so, for the last 21 years, by teacher invitation, I'm invited into classrooms. And I walk in, I tell you, Julie, every time I do, I see a sea of dead, bored eyes looking
I'm
at me.
sure.
And
Yes, I'm
it's just
sure.
a shame to see, you know, school kids just absolutely dead, checked out, you know, just completely no interest, no hope, no nothing. I mean, you can just see what if that's what they're living like. Of course there's going to be these kinds of numbers in suicide and criminality and drug addiction. It makes all the sense in the world. They're bored out of their tree. And so I go in, and in 8 weeks, you cannot believe the light in their eyes, and their hands are all raising, and everybody's excited, and they're seeing that they can learn that they matter, that their lives make a difference, that their story is powerful, and that they know. And as soon as they learn how to say things and say things in an effective way, they know how to succeed. And we're not teaching it. And now the teachers are asking me to do it twice a year, because, and I do it for free because it's too addictive. And what you see happen is just so fabulous. You just see what happens, and the kids just, they light up like Cracker Jacks, and it's just a wonderful thing to see. And
Oh,
so,
it sounds wonderful.
I mean, just one example, if you don't mind.
Oh,
One
go ahead.
many years ago, one of the first ones I led, I walked in, and it was an at-risk class. And this was a virtual enterprise class with at-risk students who had no chance of really succeeding in anything. And the teacher introduced the class to me by saying, "These kids will be lucky to get a job at McDonald's." And I was like,
Oh my
"What
gosh.
a teacher." I was like, "That's the worst teacher." Just to introduce his class like that, I was like, "Ah, oh, you are a terrible teacher." But anyway, so I taught these kids, and they really went for it. They really got it. That was so beautiful. And at the end of the class, they had to go and compete against 103 schools nationwide who are all virtual enterprise classes. And they all had CEOs and CFOs, and they had to create this business. But we had taught them how to speak, how to say something and be effective. And when they went to the contest, they swept five of the seven categories.
Wow. And your class is how long, you said?
It was 8 weeks.
Oh my goodness. Just in 8 weeks. That's
And
amazing.
it was amazing. And when they came back, the teacher said, "This is impossible." And I was like, "No, this is a
Yeah, never think that again.
your educational system. This is a failure of your educational system. If I can do this in 8 weeks, you have no excuse.
Oh,
None.
exactly.
None.
Exactly.
Zero."
Well,
And then,
and the biggest mistake is putting them in that kind of a category to begin with.
oh, absolutely. You know, it's so stupid. It is so pathetic. You know, what are kids going to say or do when they think they're at risk? They're not going to succeed. We've already told them they're failures at the beginning of their life. I am very sorry, but that's ridiculous. And of course, for another example, my own son, my second son, I had two sons. And the John, of course, was the brilliant one who never made a mistake and got straight A's and forced me to go back to school because he was giving me 45-minute debates on why he didn't need to make his bed at 5, and he was winning.
Oh
And I
boy.
realized that he was going to outstrip me in no time, and I would have no credibility, and I wouldn't be able to stay his mother. And I had to do something, so I had to go back to school and get straight A's because I got one B plus, and he crucified me for it.
Oh
And I was like, I can't let him do this to me again. So I never got another B. But what I wanted to say is my little one, who was in the shadow of a genius, a true genius that you couldn't, nobody could top. I couldn't top. Nobody could even equal him. And so he thought he was stupid. And so he went into school and they decided he was stupid and they put him in special ed. Yeah. But the teacher noticed a misfit and kept teasing him about how much extra work he was making him do grading papers late at night. And so that just spurred my son to do more until he tested out. But then he had lost 2 real years of school. And so he stayed marginal. He couldn't compete. And so, yeah. And so at 14, though, he did something really unique that I'll never forgive him for. He went and became the biggest truant San Marcos High School ever had. He
Oh boy.
has a record number of cuts from San Marcos. And, I live in Santa Barbara, and every day I'd get the call from the school saying your son never showed up. And I'd be, leaving work and flying past San Marcos High School. And I'd end up at the beach because where else is a truant in Santa Barbara going to go? And I would end up, circling the parking lot like a buzzard in my car, looking for that son of a gun, and never see him. Have to go back and, come back at home at 5 o'clock, and there he was. And I'd yell, "Hid Stonewall!" The next day, I'd do it again. But what I didn't know, and he wasn't going to tell me, is that he brought a book to the beach with him called "Getting Straight A's," which he read and reread at the beach. He was learning how to learn because he figured out that what he needed was to learn how to learn before he could succeed. And so he read that book and reread it, and I have it. It's a disaster. And when he went back to school, this is all without me knowing any of this. I just thought he was the biggest loser you ever saw in your life. And I was furious at him. But when he went back to school, he went from a 1 point to a 4 point, maintained it through City College, went on to aeronautical design engineering in Cal Poly, graduated with an offer from Lockheed, turned them down, saying, "I don't want to be an engineer." And I was like, "What do you want to do?" He said, "I want to model virtual reality with a computer geniuses." And I said, "If you can do what you just did, you can do anything you want." And he had a minor in a computer science, and so he ended up taking a $10 an hour job working in virtual reality in Santa Barbara. And a few months later, he was already in middle management when someplace in New Zealand took him away, and he was the head of all three Lord of the Rings virtual effects.
Oh my goodness.
That's the
Wow.
Stupid one.
Wow.
And so nobody's stupid.
No.
I've worked with autistic kids. I just see genius.
Yeah.
And
Well,
I.
every single person has that something in them that when they find their passion, when they find the thing that they're the best at and feels good to them, they're going to go full bore against
Yeah.
it. They're just going to do it.
But we're not teaching them the skills to do it.
No. Or to
We have.
find it. We're forcing them into categories and buckets and, labeling, and that's not helpful ever.
No, it's not. And also, grading on the curve is a problem because it's really great. If the higher ups are trying to find someone who's outstanding, so that they can put their money on those people and they get the best, they better get the best schools, the best careers, all that. What we're not teaching in school is causing so much of the disconnection that we're seeing among the adults now, because it turns out that we stopped teaching social emotional skills back in the Industrial Revolution to prioritize STEM classes, technology. And they sacrificed the stuff that is the glue that keeps society together. And so these kids, we have children who are, they don't know the way. They don't know what who they are anymore. They don't know if they matter, what they can do, what can't they can't do. So many of them are just at sea. And that creates competition. You're going to get the kids in the classroom who are not identified as anything special, believe it. And then they acted out outside of class with bullying, with cruelty, with drugs, with criminality, with all these things because they don't think they can do anything else. And they're going to attack anybody who's identified as smart, just like my firstborn. He was so smart, he couldn't help it, he just was. And he was absolutely crucified in schools because the kids, they were going to attack him every which way to level the playing field.
So is it, do you, I know it was a complete surprise when he committed suicide. I'm sure, I know for me, the first question would have been why? And was that your first question? And then how did you go about settling that for yourself?
The why is what has been motivating me ever since. Because, and I'll never probably find out everything, but what I have found out are what we're all doing wrong. I realize that I made my mistakes for sure by not understanding, exactly what how something would affect him. And I think most parents don't know that, but what I found in my when I was studying for my master's is one of the things they taught me was about Erik Erikson's Eight Ages of Man. And Erik Erikson is called the father of psychosocial theory. And he analyzed development. And at each stage, there's a new issue internally because it helps grow us to the next level and the next level and the next level. And so these are seeds inside of us, and if those seeds aren't watered in the right way, you're going to flounder and fall. And then it undermines the next stage and the next stage and the next stage. And what I found is at the very beginning of life and for a couple of times in his early development, some things happened that were not my fault, but I missed dealing with him effectively, and that is what I did wrong. And but so many of us are. And so my book is to tell the stories, John's stories. These are all true stories that took a superstar to suicide, and they're happening right now. These same stories are alive. He died, but his stories are alive, and they're happening in different ways to young people right this second. And they're doing the same thing to them as they did to him. And so my book is taking the story so that, because story is a great teacher. That's how we learn from the beginning of time. And then I'm plugging the stories into it, Erik Erikson's Eight Ages, so that you can see what mattered at that age and how that would have affected how what happened to him would demoralize him. And so he's a cautionary tale that you can learn from and know what to do better at every age. So you can keep life worth the living for yourself, for your children, for anyone. You'll know what matters, and then you'll know if you lead to this and you avoid that, you're going to keep life worth living.
Can you give one of those stories just as an example?
Yes, and this is one that started right at his birth. I was a brand new mom. I'd never been around babies before. I didn't know very much, and I picked a pediatrician because he was really old, and I thought he was seasoned. I didn't think that maybe he was senile.
Oh no.
And anyway, when John was born, I had a natural childbirth. First in Santa Barbara. You don't want to be the first. Believe me, they are not ready for you. You are just trouble.
Yeah.
And but I ended up having him, and he was perfect and he was beautiful. And I was so excited. I was just exactly what I wanted. I wanted a little baby boy, and I got him. And he just shimmered. He was just the, and he had the biggest eyes you ever saw in your life. And it was just adorable. But after birth, he cried and cried and cried. And the doctor would just tell me, this is just colic. It lasts for 3 months. After 3 months, he'll be fine, but it's just an immature stomach, blah, blah, blah. And he gave me medications for John, and they just made him worse. And he kept crying. And I was up maybe 30 or 40 times a night. I wasn't getting any sleep, and I was trying my best to help him, and nothing was soothing him. And I just was listening to the doctor, and he was like, you just have to tough it out. This is blah blah blah. And at 3 months, he was still crying. And I just said, I called the doctor, and I said, he's still crying. And you said this would be over. And he said, well, maybe it's the 4 month colic or the 5 month colic. And at that point, I just hung up on him. I was so mad, so mad. And I called around, and somebody recommended another pediatrician. I called him, and he said, bring him right in. So I brought John in, and the doctor was examining him, and he was feeling up here, and he said, oh, he said, feel right here. And he said, I said, what? And you could feel there was a bump, a lump there on the bone. And he said he broke his collarbone in birth.
Oh my gosh.
And so for 3 months, I had been holding him and doing everything, and all I did was doing was hurting him even more without knowing it. Because he's so they're so they're I didn't know. And he said, but it's starting to heal, so just stay off of it and he'll be okay. But John, from that point on, the first issue in life is trust.
Yes.
Can I trust my caregiver? Can I cr trust that she loves me? Does she hold me? Does she care for me? Does it she make me feel better? Does she feed me? Does she keep me clean? Does she play with me? All these things. And what I had done was hurt him time and time and time again. And his own body had hurt him, because when he'd move, of course, it would have been painful. So he learned his body hurt. He learned nothing but distrust. And that boy, when you came, if you went, you went toward him to touch him or anything, he'd back away. He'd be like,
Yeah.
no. And it was a reflex from what that time, and it lasted. And when he was about 10, I thought he was old enough, and I told him what happened, and he just said, "Well, I'm glad to know where I got it, but what do I do about it?"
Yeah.
And I was like, well, all I can say is it's not who you are. It was something that happened to you, and you learned to do this, but it's not who you are. It isn't natural. It was something that happened that was a horrible mistake. And I couldn't do anything about it once it was done, anyway, that
Well,
it turned
that's,
that it Yeah, it turns out that research, if you do the research, if you learn mistrust at the beginning of your life, you have a high chance of suicide later on.
that's why, and I'm glad you brought up the whole trust thing because I adopted my second child from Russia. She was 13 months old when we got her, and everything was great. She was a food hoarder for a little while because she couldn't trust that she would be fed when she
Yeah,
was hungry.
Yeah, sure.
The first time we put her down after we brought her back to the place where we were staying in Russia, after we formally got physical, got her physically. We put her down for bed, and I was terrified because I thought she's going to be up all night. This is totally strange to her, whatever. She rolled over, she grabbed the side of the sheet, stuffed it in her mouth, and went to sleep.
Oh.
Because she learned to self-soothe. She
Yeah.
learned because no one was coming to pick her up every time she cried. What happened from there is that when she went to school, when she was 5 years old, she started having behaviors that were seriously scary. Like she would stab herself in the hand with a pencil. And she would have an entire meltdown if there was a change in the itinerary. So we wound up going to active attachment behavior. To a psychiatrist that did that with us, and we learned the holding therapy where we held her, we looked at her in the eye, face to face to get her through those episodes to help her understand we're not going anywhere, we're your mom and dad, we're here for you. But just like John, she did not have the best the whole first year of her life. She was a preemie, and she was in the hospital 5 months,
Oh my
and then
goodness.
was in the orphanage. So, I get where you're coming from, and I pay very close. She's 28 now, or 27 now. I pay very close attention to her psychological makeup and the things that she says, just because I know that she has anxiety and depression.
Of course.
But she has therapy now, so.
Good. But it's so important to be able to. If I had known that my job was to have him trust me, I would have said, I need a second opinion. I need a third opinion. I can't just sit there and deal with this. But I trusted that guy, and I realized what a mistake that was, because as soon as I got to the other doctor, he was instant. He was on it like white on rice, and it was like he got it within, 5 minutes. And I was like, what have I done to my son? And it was too late. It was too late. But that was just one. There were a couple of other horrible things. And my husband at the time, his father, just kept saying, we can handle it. And I was like, no, we can't.
Yeah, the push
Yeah.
through it, push through it.
Yeah, and he's like, no, we don't need to go to a psychologist. We don't need to spend any money. He's going to be fine. No, he's not. And so, that was another thing. But it's all in the book, believe me. And but all I'm trying to do is please learn from us. Please learn from Eric Erickson, because if I had known at the time about Eric Erickson, I was like, when I got to the Eric Erickson in my studies, I was like, why doesn't every parent know this? This is so important. This is absolutely critical. If I knew this, then I'd know what to do. And we don't do it. And so the information is there. It just hasn't been put in a way that helps other people. So that's what I did. And I used my son's story because he was he never did anything wrong, Julie. He just did too well. I mean, he really didn't do anything wrong. He was the best kid ever. And he was, but he was really under some, he'd had some horrible things happen. And those things helped set him up for a suicide. But so did the schools.
Oh, sure.
So did the schools. I mean, he got in Carnegie Mellon at 16 in theoretical math. And he was one of 33 by invitation only students handpicked for this particular curriculum. And it was an accelerated course where you finish your bachelor's in 2 years and then you finish your master's in 2 years. So he had called me up and he said, well, I've got good news and bad news. He said, the bad news is I'm staying here. He said, The good news is you're paying for my graduate education, and that was because he was going to do 6 years of work in four, along with 32 other kids. And
Wow.
so Carnegie Mellon is not cheap. And we were like, oh my God,
Yeah.
this is going to just take us out. But 4 years later, he was the only student left in the program. 32 had done their best
Wow.
and crashed and burned. He was the sole survivor of his entire class. And he was the only one to walk for both his bachelor's and master's simultaneously within 4 years. But what kind of school creates a program where you lose 32 of 33 students?
Yeah, that's pretty sad.
Well, think of the money the parents put in and all the love and care that those kids were, doing the best they could, and they couldn't make it because it was set up to fail. And he was furious. He said, if I had known when I was 3% of the entering class that I was going to be 100% of the graduating class, I would never have signed up. Of course
Right.
not. Who would with those odds? But the
Right.
school had created a killer program.
Wow.
And nobody could know it. We all thought it was, this was something that was put together in a way that was pedagogically sound and everything was going to be work out and all our kids were safe. No, they weren't. So he had survivor guilt. And he also was trained to this extent where he was beyond the beyond. I've never seen a more magnificent person than John. When he graduated, he was the most magnificent person I'd ever seen in my life. And I'm not kidding. I mean, and he had just done what nobody else could do. But yet he was so very fragile because he had these hits had taken from birth on that were operating, and they were there, and I didn't realize that he was set up to fail.
Well, you, how could you? Seriously.
Well,
But
now I do.
hopefully your book is going to help a ton of other people not make some of these mistakes
Yeah.
and at least educate them to what to look out for. You know,
Absolutely.
that's half of it is you need to understand and be aware of development, like you said, with Eric Erickson. I have to say we have hardly any time left, but I have three questions that I
Okay.
ask at the end of every interview. The first one is if you could close your eyes, okay, and tell me what appears in your mind when I say wise woman.
Ah, well, there's two. There's my
Okay.
aunt. Tw I have an aunt Twyla who's 99 years old, and she
Oh.
has lived as she's a stunning example of what women can be. And she is an alpha person. You can talk to her about any subject on earth, and she is right there with you, and she can give you change on any subject whatsoever. And she's kind and she's wise and she's beautiful. And so she's one of them. And then the other one is my aunt, other aunt on my father, on my mother's side, who is Italian, and she was absolutely unstoppable. You will never see anything like her again. She was everybody, she was the toast of the town for the whole of her life. Nobody could, you just couldn't, she didn't have a mean bone in her body, but she had a wit that was,
Yeah.
and she was absolutely brilliant. And so I have,
Oh,
those are the
wow.
two that I think of when you say
That's beautiful.
that.
So, my next question is, where do you like to roam? Mm-hmm.
I am a world traveler. I do a lot of dangerous things that other people shouldn't do. I go swimming with dolphins, the wild dolphins, because I live in Santa Barbara and they're right outside, right off the coast. And I will go and jump in the water and swim with them. And they are such great teachers, and they're so full of joy and ecstasy. And it's just such a pleasure to be in there. And they somehow see me as one of them. I'm a wimp. And they like me a lot. They say
Oh, that's amazing. I love that answer.
don't you do it. They're wild
Okay.
animals.
Right. So, what makes you restless in a good way?
Oh, when I see injustice, if I see injustice, and if my the bit gets in my teeth, and I am going to go straight for it, and I will do everything I can. You know, it took me 28 years to write that book because it had to be good and it had to work. And
Yeah.
I just don't give up. I just don't. I when I see injustice, I get so angry. I'm like,
Oh,
let me go.
I'm
I'm
with
dangerous.
you. I'm with you. I'm with you there.
I've put
Well,
people in prison.
wow, that's
Yeah, I have.
amazing.
I'm very happy about it.
Good. Well, thank you so much, Sally. I really appreciate it. And say the name of your book one more time for our listeners.
Okay, The Son I Knew Too Late, A Guide to Help You Survive and Thrive. And that's my promise to the readers. You will know what we didn't, and you will be able to use it for the rest of your life with everyone and anyone,
Sounds
including
wonderful.
yourself.
So definitely, guys, take a look at the book. Make sure you grab a copy, especially if you have growing children. And like Sally said, you could use it with everyone, as a matter of fact. Sally, how can people get a hold of you? Do you have a website?
I do. It's SallyARaymond.com. And you can
Okay.
all you need to do about me and my son.
Perfect. Well, I'll put that in the show notes. Thank you so much for being with us, and have a great rest of the day.
Oh, Julie, you've been delightful. Thank you so much for being you and for
Thank
this
you.
opportunity.
Julie Noonan here. Thank you so much for listening to Roaming with Restless Women. If you're a successful senior woman leader who would like to be on this program, please visit podcast.intuitivewisdomcoach.com. If you enjoyed this interview, please share this episode on social media and make sure to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Your thumbs ups and reviews go a long way.